Okay, so we'll share some observations as we go through, both in terms of preparing for dessert and then actually eating or serving dessert. And the goal is to cover 4 to 5 different melachos, different topics that are going to come up over the course of dessert. So I'm going to hand it over to Rabbi Kraft to get us started, and then we'll move along.
Okay, so this really delicious looking cake, I think, is going to be a perfect place to start. Now, we're going to pretend that this is a birthday cake. And I don't know, I like to get things done very far in advance. I don't like to be doing things the last minute. But when it comes to birthday cake, this is something I've noticed over the years, is that when you write your letters, the happy birthday to whoever's lucky day it is, so you write the happy birthday on the cake, and then you cover the cake sometimes. Sometimes you don't have this very fancy sort of glass cover if you have some tin foil, or you never know who's going to come and start playing along with icing. So if you do it too far in advance, there's the potential for the letters to get smudged or ruined, and no one wants to look at a birthday cake and see their name all smudged. So the best thing to do sometimes is to wait till the last minute and to write the name on right before you're gonna be eating it. So when it comes to Shabbos, if someone's celebrating a birthday on Shabbos, so this could become a potential problem. Why? Because we're writing. We're not allowed to write on Shabbos, right? That's one prohibition that the Torah tells us. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to engage in active writing. How do we define writing? So the Torah defines it as writing two letters, right? Two letters that form they don't have to form a word, but two letters is considered a significant act. So therefore, that's considered a biblical prohibition of writing. Not only letters, but also symbols or pictures or anything else that would be a significant image that would be formed. So that would be under the biblical prohibition of writing. And so, if you want to have your cake on Shabbos, so that would pose a potential problem. Now, are there potential ways around that? So here we have these very fancy, these look like aerosol sort of cans that you could, I guess icing is going to come out of them.
Yeah.
So now there's actually a question which is a little bit beyond today's topic, which is because I normally think of these icing things as coming from these squeezing pipers. So this actually poses an additional question, which is the question of molded, whether or not you are, through the process of pushing down and creating the pressure that makes the icing come out or whatever it is going to come out, if there's a reaction in the can that actually creates something that wasn't there before Shabbos. So I don't know exactly how these cans work. I know in general, like with whipped cream, there's a discussion because it might be in the form of liquid inside, so I'm not exactly sure. There might be a separate question, but we're going to put that aside. But if you're talking about just piping or you're talking about just creating letters, so this would be, the Rambam actually points out that when it comes to writing, normally we think of a pen and paper. Well, it doesn't have to be a pen and paper. Any sort of ink or any sort of substance which would create a letter or a form is going to be a violation of writing. So when I'm pouring this out here, let's see how this works. Ooh, happy birthday. So this would be actually a violation of Ksiva, and it actually is pretty much... This will last. This will not dissolve on its own. There is a question if you have something if you have water or some sort of liquid or grape juice on the tablecloth and you start to kind of move it around with your finger. So maybe rabbinically that's problematic because you are forming letters. But since it's not going to last, it wouldn't be a biblical prohibition. But this is going to be a question of a biblical violation. So this form would not be a good idea. So there is actually, there's another thing that might come to mind, which is, well, wait a second, and this my kids would probably really like to do. So what if I take my finger and I don't want to ruin this cake, but what if I would just take my finger and say, well, I won't actually use any sort for the form of icing or anything that's going to create an additional appearance on the cake, but I'll just, the icing is smooth very nicely, I'll just engrave or etch out with my finger, or maybe I'll be a little bit more polite and I would take a knife or something and I would etch out the letters. So the Rambam tells us that that also is a form of writing, because anything that's going to form letters or an image on a surface is going to be a violation of writing.
Meaning, like, don't do it in the snow even?
So if you do it in the snow, so doing it to go with an intention to write in the snow, that potentially would be a question. They do discuss, well, what happens if I have on the bottom of my shoe? The host can discuss. If I have on the bottom of the shoe, sometimes you have a little symbol with the name of the make of your shoe. So every time you walk, you can get that nice little imprint of your foot with that name. So did you just, by walking, write that name of the shoe. So that is actually a discussion in the postgame, and generally we are lenient on that. That does not pose a problem. But in terms of if I would go ahead and try and take some snow, and then I would start, you know, carving my name in the snow, so that could be a potential problem of Ksiva.
Could you put letters, like gummy letters?
Great. So what would be, if you would, so now, if I would take, you know, you said gummy bears, so in theory, gummy bears is, you know, if I'm forming them to be a letter, and I'm doing it in such a way that they're going to stay, right, if I'm kind of pushing them into the cake and they're going to stay, so that could potentially be very similar to if I'm taking icing or anything else. But what if you have those alphabet cookies, right, with the letters already pre-stamped and formed onto the alphabet cookie? So then I could just, you know, pick out, get to the Boer questions in a minute, but say I had them all of the letters that I needed picked out already or set aside. So I'm going to pick out, and I would just stamp each one on the cake, right? It might look a little bit different than your average birthday cake, but it could do, you know, the HAPPY, and get the happy birthday through affixing those cookies onto the cake. So this is actually the subject of a little bit of a machlokas in the poskim, because the Magen Avraham tells us on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, so he tells us that even if you don't form the letter from scratch, even if you take a preformed letter, but you affix it to an already existing surface, so that's problematic. And the question is, why is that problematic? Because it could be problematic, like the Sefer Shmir Shabbos Kehilchos says by Rabbi Neuwirth. He says that it's problematic because if you have a preformed letter, even though the letter itself is preformed, by affixing it to a surface, so then what you've done is you've added significance. A letter on its own is completely insignificant. He says, affixing it to the surface, having a letter written on something, that is the violation of Ksiva, of writing on Shabbos as well. However, Moshe Feinstein says that that's not the problem. The problem is that if you've taken something and you've affixed it permanently onto another surface, so it's the permanence that's the problem. So the difference between these two opinions would be, well, what if you have something that is already on a surface, like the alphabet cookies, right? The alphabet cookie is not just a standalone letter, like maybe one of those magnetic letters that we put on the refrigerator. So if you affix the letter to a refrigerator, that might be a question of, well, I'm taking a letter, I'm putting it on the surface. But if you have an alphabet cookie which has the background already there, it's not, you're not affixing the letter per se, you're taking the entire entity and you're putting it on the cake. So according to the opinion of Rav Neuwirth in Shmir Shabbos Kehilchosa, that would be totally fine, because the letter already exists and it's already on a surface. All you're doing is taking the letter on its surface and putting it next to each other. It's the same thing, he says, as arranging, you know, if you have cards and you're just arranging cards right next to each other. One card's over here and I put it over here next to another one, so that I didn't violate anything on Shabbos, right? It's just taking letters and moving them around, rearranging.
What happens if they were letters just the shape of a letter?
Right, so according to Rav Neuwirth, if it was a standalone letter, that would be a problem, because as a standalone letter, it's not legible until I affix it to a surface in a certain order. Okay. Now, if it wasn't affixed, you know, if you're just kind of moving the letters around, that's not a problem. But if you're affixing it by sticking it into the surface of the cake so it's not going to move, so then that would be a problem. But according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's a problem no matter what, because he doesn't care about the fact that it's on a surface. For him, it's just taking something and permanently affixing it in a certain order.
But aren't you cooking your goose? Because once you put the letters there, aren't you going to run into trouble when you cut slices?
Oh, excellent. So we're going to get there. You're a step ahead of the game. We're going to get there in a second. First of all, I just point out, I think the custom, there are various customs in this. I think both positions, some people take the stringent opinion and don't affix letters to things. Others are comfortable with the Shmir Shabbos Hilchos, so that as long as it's already on a surface, you have an alphabet cookie, to rearrange those even in a somewhat of a permanent fashion would be okay. Another just interesting, this has nothing to do with dessert, but another, you know, maybe after dessert, you might want to go into the living room and play a game of perhaps Scrabble or Bananagrams. So there would actually be a difference between these two opinions in that realm as well, because Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about how if you take something and you affix it in a permanent way, like in a Scrabble board, where you have each letter goes into a little box, or that little, you know, little etched out box, and it's not going to move. So even though the letter itself is on a square, on a surface, and it already has its own surface, but by taking each one and affixing it in its own spot, Rav Moshe would Moroche's logic would dictate that would be problematic, whereas Bananagrams is taking the same pieces sort of as Scrabble, but just rearranging them in different orders, and you're not affixing them in any permanent fashion, so that would be...
Cheap
Scrabble Wars, exactly. Not the deluxe edition.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you say it's etched into a square, you're talking about deluxe Scrabble.
The deluxe Scrabble, exactly.
But I have a question. But the whole concept of permanence, this is what I don't understand about games. When playing the game, the intention is, okay, it's not like, like some people say you shouldn't do a puzzle because you might pour glue over it and make it permanent, okay? But a game like Bananagrams or Scrabble, it's not permanent. You might want to play it 20 times over Shabbos.
Right. I don't want to get too diverted onto the games thing, but the basic notion is when we talk about permanence, it's not necessarily a question of, well, is it, has it been cemented into the board that now you could need a sledgehammer in order to undo it? If it's done in such a way that without some sort of action to like specifically undo it, it wouldn't really get undone on its own, so then that could have a degree of permanence, as opposed to something like Bananagrams where you leave that out for 3 seconds, and something's going to happen to it. Whereas Scrabble, the pieces are kind of more in place. I think that's the distinction that this halachic authorities are discussing.
The other thing is you're addressing an important question, which is if your intention is only for it to be temporary. So that is it's a further question in general in the Malachos of Shabbos when you have something that you intend to be temporary, but as a matter of principle is permanent. So it comes up in the Malacha of Bona, of building, let's say the difference between Lego, which is a question, because it could stay there forever. You can have a Lego that could last for 10 years, but your intention is to only leave it for a few minutes, versus, let's say, you're going to build a brick house in the backyard, but you're only going to do it for temporary purposes. So there would be a big distinction there. Generally speaking, houses... you build a brick house, it's going to last. So therefore, the fact that you intend it only to be temporary, that might be not enough of a mitigating circumstance, whereas in the case of the Lego, generally speaking, it's only binyan l'shah. So that's a big discussion in the later authorities about how temporary is temporary and what the definition of permanence is.
Great. If there are questions on the formal act of ksiva in terms of letters, then we can take it that, but it looks like people were comfortable asking. Yeah?
For those who would not put even those letter cookies on the cake, would they put it around, the little ledge around?
Oh, because then it wouldn't be affixed onto anything. I think that they would, if you would want to put it around on the base of the cake plate, where it could very easily be moved without any great efforts. It would just kind of be loose and freestanding, so then that would be okay according to everybody.
So before we continue with any more writing on the cake or shaping the cake, let's think about for a second the story of frosting the cake. Is there an issue with frosting a cake on Shabbos?
Do you want my froster?
That is amazing.
And this is a serious froster.
That is a very serious froster, so I'm not going to try to use that. But... we have a principle, it's based in a comment of the Mordechai, we're going to mention him again later. The Mordechai lived in the 13th century, he was a great rabbinic luminary in Ashkenaz, he was murdered in the Rindfleisch massacres of 1298, and he records that when it comes to food products, they are not subject to the laws, the regular laws that come into the process of, let's say, building or making clothing on Shabbos. You can't build a cake. Even when you talk about building a cake, there's no such thing as building a cake. So there is one malacha, for example, that comes up in the context of tanning. So let's say you have skin that's not smooth. So there are two ways that you can smooth out the skin. You can either take a thin razor and shave off the bumps of a piece of leather. You could just smooth it out by removing the bumps, or you can take some kind of viscous liquid and fill it in so that it's smooth on top. Two different ways of dealing with it. Those preparatory steps in creating, let's say, a leather garment or a piece of cloth, that is a problem on Shabbos. One is called memachik, erasing, by scraping off the top layer so that it's smooth. The other one is called memareach, filling it in with something like certain creams for use on Shabbos. What they're doing is they're memareach, they're smoothing the skin by filling in the little pores with the lotion. So here I am, I'm looking at my cake. So the Mordechai says, no, there's no problem. There's no problem of memachik and memareach on Shabbos. And this is quoted by the Ramah for Ashkenazim in the 16th century. However, he says, if you want to be stringent, so then there's a place to be stringent. Because even though technically speaking, we should say that this cake has nothing to do with a piece of leather or a building, nonetheless, conceptually, if you frost this cake, then you are smoothing it out. That may be a problem of memachik, of smoothing, and therefore there's a reason to be careful. And the Magen Avraham, Rav Avram Abba Gombiner from the 17th century, Rabbi Kraft mentioned before, he says, you know why there's no problem to really smooth out this cake? Would you eat it if the frosting was globbed? You would eat it. So therefore, let's be honest. If you were just kind of like globbed on the top, you would eat it anyway. So therefore, the Magen Avraham says, by taking your special designer froster thing from the craft's house and smoothing it out, you haven't really accomplished anything. You haven't really transformed anything. And therefore, it's not a malacha. But therefore, the Magen Avraham says, let's say there's something, and it's hard to think of what that would be, but that if there's something that you really would not eat it unless it was smoothed out, so then that potentially could be a problem of memachik, of smoothing something on Shabbos. I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, maybe if you were a baker and you have a display of birthday cakes.
So then maybe.
So then,
even
you
that,
might,
I wonder.
It might be that you don't want.
Otherwise.
Or you would never put your globby icing birthday
maybe.
Cake in your display.
Good question. I'm not sure. And the other thing to keep in mind, though, is that therefore, let's say you have, you're serving those ice cream sandwiches. So that would not be a problem because you're just spreading the ice cream on and putting the cookie on top. Or even just think about spreading, peanut butter on a piece of bread. The Magen Avraham says that that's not a problem. So thinking about spreading and the malacha of memareach also comes into as we're putting the cake together.
Great. So you want to do about erasing letters now? Or
no, you can keep going.
One other aspect. Back to the kosev piece, which also doesn't have to do with the cake. I think we'll put the cake aside until we have to deal with the erasing of the letters. There's the watermelon over here, which I don't know if I should start cutting open right now. But there's another aspect of dessert preparation that relates to kosev, because we mentioned that writing can be done in the normal sense or the intuitive sense, which is talking about actual letters, or we can talk about shapes or pictures, or we can talk about actually forming some sort of sculpture. So, I'm not very good at sculpting fruit, but sometimes if you would be in attendance of a wedding or an event where they would have a dessert table set up, so often you'll find that the watermelon would be, for example, a great thing. Melons will be sculpted, they'll be cut off and carved on the side, sometimes maybe to look like a flower. I don't know, maybe if you have a certain theme for your dessert, you would shape the melons in, I don't know, a kangaroo shape, whatever your theme might be, you would try to form the fruit and you would sculpt it into this shape. So now, sculpting or forming a form can also be an issue in terms of the question of kasiva as well. So the Mishnah Berurah talks about how taking a food item and making it into a, shaping it into a form. This could also be done with dough, if you were to try and shape the dough into a certain form to be, the cookie should be a certain shape or something like that. So if you would shape certain things, or soft chalva, whatever things could be shaped into form, so if you were preparing that on Shabbos, so that could be a potential problem as well. However, there's something that's probably a little bit more common for the household, which is, I don't know if you have one of these. I tried to look for one at home, but I couldn't find it.
A melon baller.
Exactly. Because there are different ways of cutting your watermelon. You could cut it, you can chop it up, and then you can just chop it into squares. You could chop it up into triangles.
Oh, that's it.
Or
that's awesome.
You could use, right, if you're...
You're scared of the big one.
Oh wow, that I don't even know what it is. But sometimes if you want to have a very shapely fruit bowl or fruit salad, so you might want your watermelon to be a perfect circle. So the use of a melon baller to form these very fine, pretty balls, you can see. So this forms a perfect shape. So the question that some posts can deal with is, well, is that considered forming a particular shape on Shabbos that would be problematic? So I believe I was actually looking today to find where I saw this, because a number of years ago I saw someone who wanted to be machmir on this question and say that you could not use a watermelon baller. But it always struck me as a little bit strange, because I never really understood what's the difference between taking this object, which is formed with some sharp edges in order to form a ball, or taking this object, which is formed with sharp edges, and cutting it and then forming a square or a triangle or whatever else, whatever other shape comes about. So I actually spoke to Rav Chaim Twersky this morning, and I asked him what his opinion on the matter was, and he agreed that, in general, he didn't really see how this sort of shape, even though it's a very, very nice, pretty shape, how this is what the Mishnah Berurah is talking about when he says that you can't form a shape out of food. His distinction was, well, are you forming just a shape that represents something, or are you forming a shape that everything is a shape? So if it's a shape that's supposed to represent something else, so if I'm carving my watermelon to look like a flower, so the shape that I'm making is so that the watermelon resembles something else. But if it's a shape just because it happens to be a circle or a square or whatever other shape, that's not a shape that's supposed to represent something else. That's not ksiva. That's not a violation of writing on Shabbos. That is just however I decided to form or make into smaller pieces my watermelon. So that seems to be a reasonable practice, in that watermelon balling, there certainly would be room to be lenient if you would want to have such a salad.
So we're going to come back to the cake and follow through with this same theme again. I'm going to bring it over here so it'll be a little bit closer. The same question is going to come up also in the malacha of kosev and its application on the top of the cake. Meaning, just like we said, you're not allowed to write letters, you're also not allowed to be, you wouldn't be permitted to draw pictures on the cake either, because pictures are also shapes. So here is my cake. Right now it's going to say, you see that? Now I'm going cursive for a minute. So this is going to say happy. Obviously that's not permitted on Shabbos. What if I do this? And the blue one.
Whoa.
Don't scare yourself. Now. Take a look. What do you think that looks like? What's that? It does not look like
a flower.
What does it look like?
Oh, it's a flower.
It looks like a flower. So that would also be prohibited on Shabbos. But what if I did this? Would it be permitted to do just this? So that's a question. Is that considered a drawing, or is that just random lines? If I do this on the edge of my cake, so then that would be permitted. That's just crisscrossing lines. There's no significance to that, so this will be a distinction.
Like Rabbi Kraft said,
exactly, and that's why I was putting it out. If it's a form of some kind, if it's a special art design, if it's a design of something, so then it would be problematic. But just putting random squiggles on the cake, that's not random squiggles, that is a flower.
It's like a flower to one person and a flower to another person.
So, be careful about it. So now here we have our cake. So that's the question now. So the reason why this is a good segue is because whatever you're not allowed to write, you're also not allowed to erase. There is a malacha of kosev, and then there is a malacha of moche, of erasing. So the question becomes, does cutting a cake with letters on it pose a problem of moche, of erasing? It's a good question. So the Mordechai, we mentioned him once before, I'll mention him again, he mentions the practice that used to be on Yom Tov, children would have the custom to eat cookies that had the shapes of letters on them. He says, why is that not a problem? He says, because first of all, the erasing is not for the purpose of writing. And the malacha of mochek is amanas lichto, for the purpose of writing. That's number one. And number two is that they're kids, and because they're kids, if you're not telling them to do it, if they do it, you don't have to stop them to do it on Shabbos, because it's only a rabbinic violation. It's not for the purpose of writing, therefore it's not biblical, it's rabbinic. And because it's rabbinic, if a child is doing it on their own, you don't have to stop them.
But I think so cutting is not erasing. Erasing is like smudging it.
Okay, great. So
cutting
here's...
is just separating...
So here's the problem.
Plates.
Oh, thank you. So we're going to get out of plates right now. So as a matter of principle, this is exactly a debate among major authorities. Because the Ramah, or Moshe Isserlis, again, quotes this idea of the Mordechai, to be concerned about the malacha of mochek by cutting, well, by eating cake, cookies that have, so now I'm going to take this, I'm going to cut right here. This cake looks fabulous. Now here's the question. In point of fact, when I cut this cake right now, I really did kind of destroy the letter somewhat. But if you look at it, imagine I took this piece out. You're pointing out that I didn't actually erase it, assuming that I didn't do what I just did, which was cut all the frosting off, and now the letter P actually isn't there anymore. But assuming that I just cut it, then have I really erased it? Really what I've done is I've taken one letter and I've split it into two. Or, even better, I stuck my knife in between two letters and I cut it into two. So now this becomes a big discussion among the rabbinic authorities after the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, after the 16th century. Some authorities say, yes, because you have deconstructed the word, or in this case, you have deconstructed the letter, so that poses a problem of erasing, because you had a letter that was written, and now it's no longer written. Other authorities say, no, what are you talking about? I didn't actually erase anything, I just separated one part of the letter from the other. This becomes a major debate in the context of books. That was me in this house, they had a lot of books. So some books have writing on the, what do you call that? Not the spine, the other side. The part where the books open up. You know what I mean? So when you, like, when you borrow a book from the YU library, not the binding side, the opposite side, the opening side, on the paper, it says there's a stamp that says Mendel Gottes in the library from the Torah library. So when you open that up, some authorities say, oh, you did mochek, you erased. And when you closed it, you did kosev. And then other authorities say, get out of here! It has nothing to do with mochek and kosev, it's opening and closing a book. So that's one debate. Then there's a further debate that says, wait a second, when you ask me what I'm doing when I'm cutting this cake, I say, I am cutting cake. I'm not erasing. So my intention, coming back to what you said before about intentionality and permanence, that's going to play a big role here as well. I'm not intending, right? If you ask me what I'm doing, I'm not erasing, I'm cutting cake. So here too, there is another question. Yes?
You said that also, that it's erasing with the intention for writing. You're not redoing it.
Exactly. So therefore, that's another...
name wrong.
Exactly. So therefore, it would only be, as Andrea's pointing out, only be rabbinic in the first place. Because you're not intending to write. You're not intending to actually erase anything in the first place. You're just trying to cut the cake. Then there is a further distinction that the Magen Avraham, again, Rabbi Avraham Avalugam here from the 1600s, he says is, you quote from earlier sources, that there should be a distinction between when I cut the cake with a knife versus when I eat it, when I eat a cookie with my mouth. Then I'm just eating. How can you even claim that I'm doing erasing? I'm just eating. It happens to me that as I'm eating, it becomes consumed. So practically speaking...
So if you like a cookie with a name on it, those bar mitzvah cookies.
Right.
Oh, so...
not a problem.
So that, I'm sorry, that was the Taz. Rav David Alevi, that was the Taz, who says that I'm eating it. The Magen Avraham says one other distinction, which is what you're raising, which is maybe there's a difference between when I have happy written in some other letters versus I have something embossed on the item. That's the Magen Avraham's addition. And he says, if I have something embossed, then cutting it open, that doesn't matter. There's no problem to eat or cut into letters if they are only embossed, because you've never actually formed the letter outside of the substance that you're dealing with. So those are the four issues that become kind of bounced around. Number one, biblical versus rabbinic, so it's not for the purpose of writing. Number two, what's your intention? Number three, the question of eating versus cutting. And then number four, the question of, is it a standalone letter or is it just part and parcel of the object? So different poskim have different rabbinic decisors have different opinions. So many Ashkenazi poskim are machmir, but generally speaking, they're only machmir to break letters like this that are formed on top of the cake. But if I took the cake and before Shabbos I wrote happy birthday by engraving it, then many poskim would say that's not a problem. And others would say, And Rabbi Avad Yosef has, in his tshuva in the Yabi Omer, he thinks that mi'ikra din, even cutting the letters themselves, if the chips are down, one would be permitted to do that. So the idea...
But is he questioning just for sparting? I mean...
So that's... No, that's a different question. Rabbi Avad says that it's mutter, and he's not discussing sparting versus Ashkenazim. Generally, his psak is across the board. So I would say it's one of those most preferred versus in case of need. Most preferred, the Ramah says, we should avoid cutting letters on Shabbos. And therefore, in many bakeries, when you ask them to make a happy birthday, they'll put it on a cookie or on a piece of plastic. Less preferred is to eat it rather than cut it with a knife. And then the most preferred after that would be not to have it written in letters, but to have it etched into the cake, and then eating this for sure.
Is there any,
you make a like the mug up from. Yeah.
Is there any difference between cutting between the letters so one letter comes out as opposed to breaking the body of a letter?
Yes, that is also a discussion. Different ways of looking at that.
I assume, that cutting around the letter is better than breaking the letter.
Right. That's also one consideration. I think Shmir Shabbos mentioned that. Okay, any questions, comments, or observations thus far? Okay, great.
Okay, so should we move on to some of the, I guess, the ancillary desserts? Or, I mean, for some people, they might not be ancillary. I love candy.
Appreciate that. Look at this. Amazing, thank you.
Okay, so we have in front of us a number of other dessert options, right? When you come to the Polster home, you don't just get one dessert option, you get a number of dessert options. So all these dessert options, what they have in common is that they are mixtures of multiple different types of items. So we have a fruit salad here, where we have strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, pineapple, looks delicious. We've got our candy mixtures of different colored Mykonites, each one with their own juicy, fruity flavor. And, of course, the Chex Mix type of mixture here with pretzels and other assorted chip-like products. So, for some people, they see these things and they just take the whole thing on their plate and they'll just eat all of it. So then that's not a problem. What if I'm a little picky and I only want to eat certain parts of the fruit salad or only certain colors of the Mykonites? So we know that there's an additional prohibition on Shabbos, which is called sorting, or taking out the bad from the good, removing that which is bad. It's called borer. And that is prohibited on Shabbos. So when you have these sort of mixtures in front of us, is there a way to go ahead and eat just those parts that we want without being in violation of the violation of borer? So there are a few principles that we have to keep in mind whenever we're dealing with a mixture. So the first question we have to ask is, well, do we have a bona fide mixture in front of us? Right? Because sometimes you could have multiple items in the same bowl, but if they're very large, for example, or if they're all the same sort of species, there's not really a major difference between, you know, maybe if you have white cookies that are colored with food coloring that's pink, and cookies that are colored with food coloring that's blue. But they taste the same, and everything else about them is the same, they just look a little bit different. Right? If they're all the same species, so that really isn't quite a mixture. Or if you have things that are so big where everything is so distinct and so easy to pick out, it's also not really quite a mixture. But here we have...
Picking the best cookie.
I'm sorry?
So picking the best cookie. You have a plate of Oreos and, you know, you're looking to... You want... That's not sorting. You want
right. Presumably, unless there's an objective reason to see that there's a mixture of all different types of Oreos. But generally speaking, if you've got a plate of Oreos, that's all one sort of item. So I want this one, I'm going for that one. That's generally not going to be considered taking something out of a mixture. Because to be in a mixture, you have to have a lot of different species altogether. It has to be a different meaning. So these are all pretty good bona fide mixtures. So now, once you have a mixture, so you have to ask yourself, oh, wait a second, if I only want to have the strawberries, or if I only want to have the pineapple, so how can I do that? So the problem of Boer is if I would take what I don't want and remove it. Right, so if I take on my plate a whole spoonful of this salad, and then what I do is I throw out in the garbage the blueberries and the strawberries, because that I don't want to eat, and then I eat what's left, so that would be a violation of borer. But if, the Gemara says, but if you take something that you want, it calls the ochel mitoch hapsolet, the good from the bad, in order to eat it, to consume it immediately, so then That's not boer, as long as you do it with your hands or a kli that is not made specifically for the purpose of separating. So if I want to eat the strawberry, so if I have this mixture and I want to eat the strawberry, so I can hone in on a strawberry that I think looks particularly good. I can pick it up with my hands, or I could even take a fork, because a fork is not by definition used to separate. It's just used to be polite.
Right, but exactly. Even if it's not a specialized piece of equipment, you can't use a vessel for separating. A fork is permitted because it's like an extension of your hand, right? It's just because you're not being rude. You don't want to stick your hand in somebody else's, right? All right.
So even if I would take a fork, so I would take the strawberry out and I would put it on my plate for a consumption somewhat immediate. There's a whole discussion about how do you define immediacy. But generally speaking, especially in the context of desserts, no one's waiting too long before they eat their dessert. Dessert's always immediate, but there is a discussion in terms of, like, if you're preparing for something in advance, how far in advance are you allowed to engage in acts of boer for that to still be considered immediate? And just for the record, generally the most accepted position is that as long as you're preparing for something in a reasonable fashion, like if I'm preparing for my meal, and it normally takes me an hour before the meal to prepare, so in that hour, it's called preparing for immediate use. Yeah?
Are you allowed to scoop onto your plate and then use the fork to take what you eat?
For sure.
Okay.
You don't have to set it from the main thing. In fact, what you're getting at is actually an additional piece to the puzzle, which is that sometimes if it's only called separating that which you don't want if you only take one thing. So if I take a whole, if I take a whole spoonful here, so even though I only want the raspberries, so I'm not separating the raspberries because I have the whole. I took the whole mixture, right? So that's not called. That would not be called boer. So long as you have other parts of the mixture in what you've taken, so that's for sure not considered a violation of boer if separating inappropriate or in a violation of the principle on Shabbos. Those are some of the major principles of boer. I think, did I miss anything? Anything to add? I think that's good. We have one more thing.
Colors doesn't matter?
I'm sorry?
With the colors, the mic and
knife? Oh, so the colors again. So the colors would be considered a mixture because... Again, each of these colors, even though they're the same species and they're all myconites, but each one has a distinct flavor. So, I love the strawberry the most. So if I'm going to want to take the strawberry, so if I take a handful and then I throw the yellows back in because they're disgusting, so that would be boer. But if I pick out the light pink ones and eat it, so that would be the same application of the principle.
Okay, so let's start to segue a little bit from boer on the dessert side to coffee and tea. Because that'll be where we're going to end up. So the rule of thumb, as Rabbi Kraft said, is if it's ochel mitoch hapsolos, taking what you want from what you don't want, miyad for immediate use, and biyad, using your hand or an extension of your hand, that's going to be permitted. So it'll also be permitted to do borer, let's say, right before your lunch meal. Let's say you're setting for Suda Shabbos, you're going to eat at 11:30, and you're doing all your prep work at 11 o'clock. It's okay to do your prep work for dessert at 11 o'clock, even though you won't eat dessert until 1:30 or 2, because that's immediately before your meal. So you can think, you don't have to wait to start to prepare for dessert until a half hour before dessert time. You start preparing for your dessert when you're preparing for your meal time. Okay? So all of these things are going together. The same thing you mentioned in terms of taking out some of the good with the bad, so that's also going to be true in terms of removing... things that you're preparing. Let's say you open up a bag of cherries and you find that some of them are moldy. So if you're not going to throw out the whole bag because you can identify where they are, so taking the bad ones is going to be an issue. So you can take a couple of the bad ones with a couple of the good ones, separate them out, and then wash them separately. So that's something to keep in mind. If you have moldy ones, those are considered to be two different items. And thinking about peels, wait a second. If I have a peel, it's separate from the inside, so isn't the peel potentially a problem of boer? So the Magen Avraham says, yes, that is a potential problem of boer, so therefore it's important to peel things. A, there's a question if you're allowed to use a peeler, but let's assume that you're not using a peel, you're just using a knife. It should also be done before your meal, in that close proximity zone, rather than doing it the night before, because removing the peel, removing the bed, so there's a special leniency that there's no other way to get to the food other than removing the peel. But since it's still, according to many, within the rubric of boer, of selecting, so then that should still be done right before. So here's a great question.
Wait, but isn't a bag of cherries not a mixture?
If you have moldy ones, then the moldy ones are considered a separate entity from the good ones. it's as if you had moldy cherries, which are one entity, and good cherries, which are different. You're right. If you just have two different kinds of cherries and you want to pick the big ones from the small ones, meaning the same kind, the Washington Rainier cherries, you have big ones, the small ones, you only want to serve the small ones, then that's not a problem of Boer. But if you have moldy cherries, then those are like a separate entity, and therefore it's a problem to remove those exclusively.
And how about rinsing?
So there is a discussion in the Mishnah about rinsing being a problem of Boer. That, Poskim say, is applicable when you have really a significant amount of filth. Like if you have a potato, which if it's raw on Shabbos, is generally speaking, is mukta, because we don't eat raw potatoes today. But if you had a potato that's really caked with dirt, then it would be a problem to wash it, because you're removing that which is bad. But for us, when we wash vegetables and fruits today, the pesticide that we're removing, it's basically invisible. The dirt that we're removing, it's nearly non-existent. You would never walk into a... Thank God, we live... Imagine, Baruch Hashem, what we have and what we wouldn't have. If we lived in some third world country, when you went to the marketplace, you would find fruits that are filthy. You can't go into a supermarket in America and find fruits that are filthy. It just doesn't exist. Nobody would sell them like that. So therefore, practically speaking, it shouldn't be an issue to wash your fruits, because there's no... You're not actually removing some filth. You wouldn't be separating good from bad.
Even okay. Washing
for bugs. What's that? Even washing for bugs, yes. Okay, so here's an interesting Boer question that's going to take us over to coffee and tea. Because there is an issue. If you take, let's say I have a mixture. This is iced tea. It's going to be a bad example because there's no way to deconstruct this iced tea. But let's say in some cases you have iced tea that has sediment underneath it. And I happen to love the sediment because it's very sugary. But imagine you wanted to serve the iced tea and you wanted to get rid of the sediment. And you were going to pass the iced tea through a filter. So here that becomes a very serious question, because you have iced tea and sediment. It's a mixture. And you're separating the mixture out by using a filter, which is a specialized piece of equipment. So that would be very questionable as to whether or not that's permitted. It depends on whether or not the sediment is really problematic, or just you like it better the other way. So that's the practical question. If you have filters on your sink, so how can you use a sink on Shabbos if it has a filter inside it, because you want it to remove the tiny particles? And the answer is that, truth to tell, we would not care, generally speaking, living in Skokie in the year 2015, we would not care if there wasn't a filter on the edge of the faucet. And therefore, because it doesn't matter to you, it's not significant and it's permitted. Okay, same thing for using a Brita filter. If you don't care, if you would drink it without the Brita, then it's going to be permitted because you don't really care. You're just doing it because it's nicer. So the question becomes, well, how do you brew coffee on Shabbos when you have granules and water in a mixture? So Rabbi Turov, he introduced me to this thing. I don't drink coffee, so it doesn't really register for me. But for people who drink coffee, this is a big thing.
I'll show you the filters. So people can see
it. So what it is a plastic dish that some guy had a genius einfall, so to speak, where he's going to just put a piece of plastic and then you put the filter on the top. So here's the problem. You put the coffee granules in here, then I'm going to take my cup and put it underneath. Let's just stay still, like that. And then I'm going to take my hot water and put it, am I doing this right so far? I'm going to put it right through. So is this a problem of Boer? Because right here at this stage, you have a mixture of water and coffee grinds. Grounds? Grinds? What do you call them?
Grounds.
Grounds. You see how much I drink?
You're like me. I don't...
Okay.
I know how to make it.
So here's the thing. This is permitted.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Right? Because the Gemara has an
exactly
parallel application of this. And this is the answer. When I have this in my hand,
right,
what do I have?
Just water.
Just water. Rabbi Kraft is going to talk about how hot it is in a minute. But all I have in here is water. So am I separating anything right now?
No.
No. When I get to the bottom, what do I have?
Coffee.
Water.
Right? Just colored water. Flavored colored water. So am I separating anything on the bottom?
No.
No. What's happening is, and the Gemara has an analogy, in those days it was talking about pouring water over sediment to make it taste like grape juice, a little bit of wine. So the Gemara says that this is permitted. And that's because the only act of separating happens incidentally through the process. But as a matter of purpose, I am pouring one cup of water into the other, and I'm absorbing the taste and the color and the flavor as it goes through. But I'm not actually separating. If I had in my hand sediment, coffee grounds, and water, and I sifted some of them out, that would be a problem because I began with a mixture. It goes back to what Herve Kraft started with, which was, do you have a mixture? And the answer is, in this case, no. There's no mixture, there's just water. So even though, yes, as it passes through, there is an incidental mixing and then straining, but since it is not direct, it is permitted to use this. I checked with Robert Tversky today, he agreed that it would be permitted. All right, so why don't you, yes?
Okay, so I love that because I'm a coffee person. Great. French press.
I don't know what that is.
Okay, so what it is you take the coffee, you put it in the bottom of a glass.
Okay.
You pour hot water into it.
Okay.
You put a cap on it that has a
filter.
It has a filter.
Okay.
A press.
A press. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you push the when you pour the water in, it mixes up with the grounds.
Okay.
And you press the grounds down to the bottom, and then through the filter, you pour off the coffee.
It's like the reverse of that.
Yeah.
Well, not quite.
No, I can see that could be a problem.
So when I looked it up,
so good.
Okay.
Yeah, I can see that being a problem.
Okay. So when I looked it up, if you use, first of all, cliché-y.
Okay, you'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah,
we'll
get that in a second.
It's not cooking.
Right.
There's a problem with cooking. But this concept of what you're taking is, you're leaving the bad on the bottom, and you're just taking from the top. So there was a question about that.
But is it all mixed together at any points?
Yeah, the problem is that in this case, before you remove the liquid, you have a bowl of a mixture. You have coffee grounds and hot water.
But it's still the same as what you have basically sitting on the
counter. Oh, but there's a crucial difference. Okay. The crucial difference is that at no point am I holding a mixture. That's exactly the difference. In this case, I have a glass of water, and then I have a glass of clear colored liquid. I have a glass of water and I have a glass of clear liquid. If I took this in my hand and I had a glass of water and a glass of clear coffee grounds and I mixed them together and then I did this press thing where I flipped it upside down and basically was able to extract the water from it, then I would be using the filter as a filter to remove the water from the sediment. So I could see how that could be potentially problematic. I can't say specifically because I don't see it in front of me, but I could see how that would be a problem. All right, let's get to the water.
Okay, great. So it's perfect that you mentioned the question of the cooking part of this whole discussion, because whenever we're dealing with creating coffee or tea, so there's the question of, well, to what degree, right? We're dealing with very hot water, right? When we talk about the temperature of water that would become the problem of cooking on Shabbos, Anissa or Bishul, so we're talking about a degree that's referred to in the Gemara as Yad So Ledesbo, right, hot enough that if someone would touch it or if it would be poured, it would make us coil, you know, take, you know, sort of recoil from the heat. It would burn. So that temperature, it's a debate amongst the poskim exactly what is the number value of that temperature, but it's somewhere in between the 110 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit range. So depending on whether, you know, if you're talking about cooking, so we would say we generally take the most stringent view in any given circumstance. So for our purposes, we're talking about cooking. So if it could be a problem of cooking if we're dealing with water that's already 110 degrees or so Fahrenheit. So the question is, so when is something a problem of cooking and when is it not a problem of cooking when it comes to water? So we have three types of kalim that we have to keep in mind, three different types of vessels called the kli rishon, kli sheni, and kli shlishi. So those are the three types of things we have to keep in mind, and what each one can do. It's very straightforward. A kli rishon would be any sort of heating vessel, an urn, for example, anything that has a heating element. So when a kli that is being heated on a heating element, a flame or a red-hot coil, whatever else it would be, so that is called, whatever kli is on that, whatever vessel is on that, that is called a kli rishon. Now the halacha of a kli rishon is that it is considered in halacha to be able to cook something. So therefore, we're never ever putting anything into a kli rishon on Shabbos. And this is true even if the kli rishon is currently not on the fire, it's currently not being heated, even if it's taken off. as so long as it is still hot enough that it is yadso lettuce bowl, so then that's considered a kli rishon, and it would be considered cooking on Shabbos. So that we don't ever put anything into a kli rishon. Now, what if you take from our urn, which is a kli rishon? I'm assuming I'm going to put in this. So you put it into this lovely earthenware little pitcher. So here, now I have, it came from a kli rishon, and now it is in a kli sheni. So the water is pretty much, I just did it a second ago, it's probably the same temperature. It's very hot. I don't know exactly what it would be, but somewhere in the range of 110, if not more, degrees. So it's very, very hot. It's still, but it's in a kli sheni. So when it comes to a kli sheni, there is a principle that a kli sheni does not cook. If I were to put something in here, it would not be able to cook anything that was raw. But the only problem is that there are certain items that are considered to be very easily cooked. So even though if I would take a raw piece of meat and put it in here, it wouldn't get cooked, but if I would take certain things such as, we're talking about tea, we're talking about coffee, so it's something like a tea leaf, so that actually might get cooked. Now the Gemara, we have a whole discussion of what types of things are easily cooked and what type of things are not easily cooked, and the tradition that we have nowadays is that because we are not experts in the exact items which are easily cooked and not easily cooked, that when we're dealing with a kli sheni, because there's potential for something to become cooked, so we refrain from putting anything that's not already cooked into a kli sheni as well, because it might be something that's easily cooked. So even though a kli sheni generally will not cook normal foods, it could cook certain types of foods which are more susceptible, more sensitive to heat. So therefore, we would be cautious not to put something in a kli sheni. Now, there is one very important difference, though. In a kli rishon, what if I have something that's already cooked, but it's going to dissolve, like instant coffee, for example? So the halacha is that in a kli rishon, we would still not put that in, even though we have a principle that once something is cooked, it can't be cooked again. When it comes to something that dissolves, because it changes its form into a liquid, the principle of something not being able to be cooked twice is more relevant for a solid for Ashkenazim than for a liquid. So because it dissolves and turns into a liquid, we still would not put that into a kli rishon. But in a kli sheni, even though I wouldn't put something raw into a kli sheni because it might be something that could be cooked, if it's something that's already cooked, like instant coffee, even though it's going to dissolve and become a liquid, in which case, if it was a kli rishon, we would maybe consider that reheating up the liquid, which would be a problem for Ashkenazim. In a kli sheni, we're not going to consider that a problem. So on that basis, for example, if you have instant coffee, it would be a, according to many authorities, it would be permissible to take your coffee and put it into a kli sheni and mix it around in order to create your instant coffee. Now, there are some, Rav Moshe Feinstein actually said for himself, he was actually stringent on this matter, that he would only use one kli more removed. So you have your kli sheni here, so then I would take this hot water and pour it into my kli shlishi. So this is my third level of transfer from the water that was being heated into my kli shlishi. So everybody says a kli shlishi that does not cook. So Rav Moshe himself was stringent that even something like instant coffee he would only make in a kli shlishi, but he says that he would not hold other people to that. So stringency, that would be something that was his own personal practice. But the notion that a kli shlishi does not cook, so that is across the board. Instant coffee and a kli shlishi, you're going to be good according to everybody. Now, there is one sort of complicating factor, and with this I think we'll end, and that is the question of a tea leaf. Because there is an opinion in the Aruch HaShulchan, and that's adopted by some of the other poskim and some of the other authorities, that a tea leaf could even cook in a kli shlishi. So that actually led to a practice, I've never done this myself, but led to the practice that if you want to actually make tea on Shabbos, you wouldn't even be able to make it by adding a tea bag into this kli shlishi, even though according to many, a kli shlishi doesn't cook, because a tea leaf is so extra sensitive to heat that it's considered to be cooking in a kli shlishi as well. And that led to the practice of creating what's called a tea essence. That's preparing a very dense or concentrated liquid of tea by pouring boiling water over tea leaves, over tea bags, and a very, many tea leaves and a small amount of water that would become very, very concentrated. And then that would sort of be used on Shabbos to add that water, which is very heavily concentrated worth of tea, and dilute it with hot water from a kli sheni or a kli shlishi. So the tea leaves never actually were heated up on Shabbos per se. So that is a practice that's out there. Rav Moshe Feinstein felt that he never, he said that he does not think that that's necessary. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, I've never heard of anything that could be cooked in a kli shlishi. A kli shlishi does not cook. That's true for instant coffee. That's true for tea. A kli shlishi never cooks, and therefore Rav Moshe thought that you could actually put a tea bag directly into a kli shlishi as well.
So one observation is, according to Rav Moshe, that a kli shlishi never cooks, that would be permitted to use even on coffee that had not been cooked, not just instant coffee. There are others who disagree with Rav Moshe who say that a kli shlishi is the equivalent of a kli sheni, but I think many are lenient. I think the Mishnah Berurah is machmer, and
Mishnah Berurah
would treat a kli shlishi like a kli sheni, but the nafka mina, with the practical difference, would be if you have coffee that was not yet cooked.
So is the filter thing the kli shlishi, or the what you're pouring the water into, you know, what should be a kli shlishi?
So the if you would do, I believe the postman say that if you do an iur, meaning if you're holding from...
It's another in-between stage called
right,
iur.
Right, because what you have is in every step of the way, you've got your kli rishon, and then you when you're pouring it into the kli sheni, so then we say that's called iur kli rishon. The halacha is that iur kli rishon, that water that's being poured at that moment onto the whatever item is in your kli sheni, so that's called iur kli rishon, and that has the same status as the kli rishon.
Right.
When it comes to the kli sheni, and you're doing iur from the kli sheni into the kli shlishi,
right,
so then we're more lenient because fundamentally the kli sheni also doesn't cook. It's just that we're extra stringent in that we don't. There are certain items that are more sensitive to heat, so we don't put them in a kli sheni. But already, once there's iur, there's already more room to be lenient from the kli sheni. I'm not sure what the practice is. I don't know what people use this. People might just for the sake of being extra cautious, just pour from the kli shlishi instead of the kli sheni, just to absolve themselves of any sort of doubt. But there definitely is room to be more lenient on the pouring side after you've gone to the kli sheni.
Any other questions, comments, or observations? Sure. So here we have a beautiful watermelon, and it has seeds in it, actually. It has white seeds, and it has some black seeds. So how are you going to get rid of the seeds? Two things to think about. The first is, if you're not dealing with watermelon, so then sometimes the seeds are in a layer on the inside of the melon, like in a cantaloupe. That would be a different circumstance. One option that you have, as Rabbi Kraft mentioned before, that many authorities suggest, is that if you remove a little bit of the fruit alongside the seed and then you discard it, so then you remove the entire mixture. So that would be one leniency. Another option would be to cut around the seeds. And then the third option would be, now this might not be the most polite way to do this at the table, but halakhically it's certainly permitted, where you put the whole thing in your mouth and you just spit the seeds out, because then doing it with your as part of the eating process won't be a problem of boer. So those are three ways to navigate that question.
Kids, all
absolutely. Absolutely.